Future Friday.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Future Friday with Hamish Hallett and John Beasy. For this week, we'll be speaking about the future of energy. So energy is a pretty big topic to speak about and a pretty important one, especially in the next coming years, especially to try and find something which is a bit more, you know, energy efficient. And so me and John will be speaking about those kind of issues. So my first kind of question to you, John, is what is the current state of energy right now?
Well, depending on where you are in the world, some countries are, you know, pretty well on the way to having a greener and more sustainable energy consumption. Other countries face more challenges, but for the most part, we still get a majority of our energy from fossil fuels and other less great forms of energy production. So we have to find new ways to, you know, get off carbon and other fossil fuels and have new cleaner ways to produce our energy, especially since, you know, our energy needs have just been, we're only going up really.
Oh yeah, definitely. I think it's the fact that, especially when we're using so many more like technologies and things like that, our energy usage is 100% going to go up. 100%.
The developing world still has to, you know, develop.
Yeah, of course.
That's, I think, the biggest issue is the getting the developing countries to kind of leapfrog over fossil fuels. Because they need to industrialize in order to have a more modern economy. But industrialization always hand in hand with often goes hand in hand with environmental degradation and greater levels of pollution and, you know, greater energy consumption.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I definitely agree with that. I find that most of the sort of countries that try and want to grow economically are unfortunately going to hamper the environment as well, especially when they're trying to produce energy through fossil fuel means. But there's also actually one country actually that I do want to note in this episode actually, and that's actually Costa Rica. You know, because I know we said the whole assumption that you can't have, you know, well, not say you can't have, but like in order for a country to progress economically, unfortunately sometimes the environment doesn't work in that same sort of future. But with Costa Rica, they've actually been able to work hand in hand with economic progress, with also helping with the environment as well. So, for example, they've kind of did a lot of things such as, you know, a lot of usage of renewable energy. So, for example, 78% of their renewable energy sources is from hydroelectric, and 18% is from geothermal and wind power. And actually on one 75-day stretch, the country was able to run on renewable resources only. And by 2050, they actually want to try and achieve zero emissions. So that country was able to do a lot of things with renewables, and also still have an impact. And also not too much of an impact on the environment, but also still having a good economic basis. So it is possible, but again, it's Costa Rica. Costa Rica is in South America, whereas a country like, let's say in Asia or in Africa, it must be very different.
Well, on the one hand, well, remember, environmentally friendly doesn't mean it just doesn't have a carbon footprint, because hydroelectric does have a huge impact on local environments and ecosystems. You have to create a dam, flood an area with water, and that destroys a lot of ecosystems and habitations, and can create greater barriers for certain populations to move across and to essentially segment them.
Ooh, okay.
Yeah. Like Canada, we get a majority of our energy, I think about 80% or so, from cleaner sources such as largely through hydroelectric. I think it's pretty much just the maritime provinces that are still on coal. And even then, we have huge potential in the Bay of Fundy, which has the world's highest tides. The problem is that it doesn't produce enough energy. The problem is that it produces so much energy that we can't actually effectively harness it. It keeps destroying our equipment.
Oh, wow. That's interesting. I didn't even know that. Okay. Yeah, because that's the thing. I feel like when I was in Canada, I kind of saw a lot of, I mean, students, just, it's a bit of too much usage on like natural gases and oil, but then that's really interesting with the whole the Bay of Fundy out of hydroelectric. That's really interesting, actually. Yeah,
that's the other thing, is that even though while we while Canada produces a lot of their electricity through renewable means, there's still the fact that you need a lot of fossil fuels to run cars, other machinery, and you know, oil is quite essential in so many manufacturing processes. We can't have plastic without it. So it's still needed in a number of ways.
Oh yeah, exactly. Especially in the west of Canada as well. You know, with like Alberta and places like that, they rely heavily on oil, on fossil fuels for jobs and things like that as well. So that's another big.
Whole other issue in that. Yeah. They've done a very poor job of diversifying their economy. They actually started off doing the Norwegian way, where they're going to put the royalties into a wealth fund. So it was called the Alberta Heritage Fund. But instead of putting their money in that, I think it only, you know, Norway's wealth fund has over $1 trillion, and I think is the world's largest sovereign wealth fund. Alberta's fund has, I think, a few hundred million since like the 80s. And they just, instead of putting their money in that, they decided, you know what, let's cut taxes and fund our government through oil royalties, because that's definitely a smart, long, far-sighted way to run our economy. And then when oil crashes, the government doesn't have means to raise revenues and get themselves out of the recession, because anything they do will just exacerbate it.
Have you seen that oil prices have gone down as well during this COVID as well, I think?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, a few weeks ago, oil futures were actually trading negatively.
Mm, wow.
But that's a different thing. Oil futures are essentially a form of gambling, but
yeah, of course.
Wall Street does it, so it's okay.
Yeah. But yeah, no, that's really interesting about Canada. The facts, yeah, because I think Canada does use a lot of natural resources, but also it tries to claim it's trying to go towards more renewable energy sources, but again it's trying to rely on, you know, these fossil fuels. But then with the UK as well, from my own understanding, I think we are trying to go away from fossil fuels. There's still a little bit of fossil fuels going on still. But I do think we're going towards like solar power as well, wind turbines as well, and those kind of things as well, in that sense. But that is really interesting, because I think it would be very interesting to see how countries, I think it definitely depends on how countries adapt, and in terms of how much resources they have, climate they are in, depending on what it is. And so that kind of leads us to our kind of next question, which is quite nicely, is like kind of, what are barriers and challenges facing, you know, the energy industry? What are the big challenges?
Well, I think a big problem is we have to find new ways of producing our energy. And, you know, we have a lot of different ways, but part of it is, you know, means of storage. I think that's probably one of the bigger issues with solar, you know, the bigger criticisms of solar panels is that, you know, they only really work for as long as it's sunny. And, well, rainy London doesn't really get a lot of sun, so that's not really great or useful, or even at, you know, even in places at night, it's not necessarily useful in that way. So you have to find effective means of storing that energy, so it can be used and outside of, you know, outside of daylight time. Mm-hmm. Same with wind energy, or pretty much anything that's reliant on certain natural forces that aren't, you know, going constantly.
Yeah, that is definitely true. And also the fact, because you're talking about like storage of energy and stuff, but because we're going to mention a bit more about like nuclear energy a little bit further in this episode, but with nuclear energy they have to kind of find a way to store, I think it's radioactive waste, I believe it is. Yes, and like, yeah, long kind of term, like radioactive waste and things like that. So that's another question or another challenge that, you know, energy has to do as well. So the actual storage of that waste.
I think when people think of renewables, they always want to have an idea of energy that is clean that is totally clean without any real consequences on the environment. And I don't think that such a thing is possible, or at least not in our, we're a long ways away from being able to manipulate and create energy in that kind of way. So we're still, there's always going to be some kind of byproducts are created. It's just a matter of, you know, is it, it could be something like nuclear where it's, you know, it's highly toxic and radioactive, but the actual, but you know, the amount of it is actually quite small and can be fairly well effectively contained. I believe all the nuclear waste in the United States can fit in one American football field.
That's a lot.
So
yeah,
that's a, like, if that's all the nuclear reactors across the United States can all fit in one football, just the waste itself fits in one football field stacked, you know, one row high. That's not a lot. That's actually quite small.
Is it small? Oh wait. So did you mean that all the new? Say this again, because I'm a little bit confused.
All the nuclear waste created by nuclear reactors in the United States, if you stack the rods lengthwise, vertically, along each, they would all take up about the area of one new American football field.
Okay, yeah, that doesn't sound huge, actually.
No, exactly. It's a very, like, it's small, it's concentrated, it can be kept and protected, rather than, you know, if you're going to produce some waste, that's something that's a lot more manageable than pumping out gases that dissolve into the air.
No, interesting. Yeah.
And what kind of fact that, you know, like, Chernobyl's a tourist site.
Oh yeah, true.
Like, that's the other thing, is even it can be contained in a safe way, in such a way that you can have, it's safe enough that people can go and take pictures for their, you know, for their Instagram story.
Yeah. No, there was like so many people coming or went to that place when Chernobyl, you know, the documentary series went out. Not documentary series, but like the drama series.
Yeah, the drama.
Yeah, sorry, not documentary. The drama series came out. Oh God, so many people flocked to it. It was quite not fascinating, but just, yeah, it was just interesting to see. What kind of other barriers would you say there is to the energy industry? Because we mentioned about climate, and we've mentioned, and I've also mentioned how we store the waste and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of other issues would you say there is?
I mean, there's always the incumbent, you know, the incumbent interests, and, you know, what creates profit and where people need to make it. I mean, oil still makes, right now it's a little different, but for the most part, oil makes money, and people make, you know, people have an interest in making money, so they're going to keep doing it until it's not.
Mm.
And while renewables are definitely coming down in price, where longer term investments in renewable energies have greater returns than traditional fossil fuels, there's still that, it's still slowly, institutions are still slowly transitioning away and divesting themselves of fossil fuels. But that's still a process. Not everyone's really getting on board with that. It's actually quite a slow process. I believe some of the largest mutual wealth managers are only now starting to say, we're going to start divesting from oil. Start divesting. That's going to be a long and lengthy process. And of course, there's other countries that, you know, there are the countries that do have their economies so heavily tied up in oil.
It's
countries like Saudi Arabia. While many countries in the Middle East are actively working to diversify their economies, they still have to, you know, do that first. And in the meantime, they're going to be pumping out oil.
Mm. Yeah, I actually saw a recent, I was just looking through Instagram, I think it was today. I was like, that's an interesting question, because the fact that the Middle East use so much oil, heavy reliance on oil. It's like, what if it gets to a situation when oil is no longer profitable, right? And I was just checking on Instagram, and I saw this sort of like little post that was basically saying that a lot of Middle Eastern countries are now looking into investing renewables. I'll try and find the actual post on my Instagram, actually. It was very interesting, actually. I saw it was a growth in a lot of it. But yeah, that's the thing. It's questionable. Sorry, go ahead. I mean,
they have the perfect geography for solar, so they can do it. They have, they're great for it. I believe
I saw a video once that said that if you put in I think if you covered the Sahara Desert in solar panels, it would produce more than enough energy for pretty much the planet.
Yeah. No, so yeah,
it's a matter of distributing that energy and storing it and whatnot.
Yeah, so I just found the post right now. So yeah, it's basically what you've just said is, yeah, solar power is actually literally on the rise in the Middle East. So this was reported by The Economist. So this graph, which I think would be difficult to show on here, but it was basically showing a graph from 2020 to 2035, there'll be a huge rise in solar power from countries like UAE, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Egypt, Iraq, Israel, Egypt, all those kind of, a lot of those Middle Eastern countries. There'll be definite growth in the rise of solar power. So yeah, I think it definitely is interesting to see, because the fact that, yeah, these countries will have to change in this sense, definitely.
Every country has to change. It's a matter of taking advantage of what resources they have, what they can do. Iceland might not be able to do a lot of solar, but they'll have plenty of opportunities for geothermal.
Yeah, no, definitely.
There's all sorts of different ways that we can produce energy, or even, there's all sorts of new ways we can do it. It's a matter of producing them, making them at scale, and making it cost effective.
Yeah. And on that note, would you say that some countries face more challenges than others in this sort of industry? Would you say, let's say, Canada, would Canada have a bit more issues because they are so reliant on natural gases than, let's say, a country I've mentioned like Costa Rica? Would some other countries have more challenges than others?
Of course, I would. Yeah, that's the other issue is I think a lot of our energy framework is at the national level. So countries are focusing on having, are focusing on having sovereignty over their energy resources. So that means every country is producing their own, but not necessarily exporting that energy. Because that's a security issue. If your country is reliant on importing energy from another country, that country, the country you're importing from has a lot of leverage over you. That's difficult, but it's not necessarily efficient for everyone to be trying to produce their own things, especially when certain countries have plenty of natural resources that could easily produce more energy than they can consume. It would make more sense to simply share that energy with other countries. Mm. So countries like Canada, I would say, probably have it easier simply because they have so many, a vast resources they can use. Canada is nearly as large as the continent of Europe and has a population, not much larger than the Netherlands. So it's, we can afford to dam up rivers and have plenty of different and have such a variety in geography to take advantage of solar, wind, and whatever kind of energies there are out there. But smaller, tiny countries, Luxembourg, what does Luxembourg have?
Yeah.
They're not going to have as many resources to exploit. Everyone's, of course, going to have opportunities from rain and solar, but that might not be enough to entirely power an economy.
So you may be thinking a variety of different energy sources is probably necessary, because that's how I feel. I feel
absolutely.
Yeah, I feel like countries do need to. And I think that the fact to rely so heavily on one energy source isn't the way forward. I think you have to use, because I just feel I look at for example, the environmental conversation, and when we speak about renewables and energy sources, a lot of people try and focus, I think, too much on the renewables and then forget about other energy sources. So I generally think there needs to be a whole conversation, like a whole scale conversation of actually using a variety of energy sources, because quite frankly, we can't do that. I think we have to look more like a broader way in terms of using energy. 100% in that sense. Yeah.
No, definitely. It's people are going. You have the Sahara Desert, you're probably not likely to be able to get all your energy just from solar panels. You're going to need a lot of conjunction between different forms of energy production to create to meet our needs.
Yeah. No, exactly. I was also speaking of energy sources, I've kind of mentioned the fact Costa Rica wants to try and achieve zero emissions by 2050, and also a lot of countries want to try and have this goal. Would you say the goal of sort of carbon neutrality is quite feasible, or would you say this is quite a big idea and might not be possible to achieve?
Well, which are we talking about? Are we talking about zero emissions or net zero emissions? Because those are different.
Oh yeah, that is true actually. Okay, then let's do net emissions. My bad. Yeah.
Net, I would say, is probably more like is quite feasible. That means that the amount of carbon you're putting out into the atmosphere is offset by an equivalent or larger amount of carbon you're taking out. So that doesn't necessarily mean, so you can have a carbon neutral economy that might still have some coal power, but whatever kind of carbon you're putting in to the atmosphere, you're also doing a lot of different kinds of technologies to facilitate carbon sequestration. So maybe having different kind of carbon capture machines or just planting a ton of trees.
Mm.
So that's definitely a feasible and realistic goal than something like zero emissions.
Yeah, that's fair enough.
They really need all you need to do is get to net zero, and then you're not really having a, once you get to net zero, then you still have an impact on the environment, but your impact is growing. And then once you get into negative, where you're starting to take out more carbon than you're putting in, that's when you're slowly starting to undo the effects of, the last 150 years or so.
Mm, absolutely. That's the thing. I've been seeing a lot of these sort of ideas and plans being, seen in the news. And it's like, how can you produce something that makes no emissions? Like, it's very difficult to do. I definitely agree with you in saying that having something that is like carbon neutrality, I think, is something that could definitely be feasible, where you have to literally, try and find a way of if you're creating emissions, you're also trying to store the amount of carbon as well. So it's just it's a way of doing it. But
carbon neutrality is the first step. You have to reach neutrality before you can reach negative emissions. Because once you reach carbon neutrality, you're not really stopping climate change. We're pretty much keeping the climate where now.
Mm.
You're not really, you haven't undone it, you're just not doing more.
Mm. Yeah.
So you gotta keep going and start taking carbon out.
Yeah. No, that's interesting. Yeah. I'd say, I think that's more of a, so maybe for countries to kind of look into that first, rather than trying to go towards such a big idea like zero emissions. Yeah, it could work.
Yeah, well, it's getting to zero emissions necessarily requires you get to carbon neutrality, and that's the only other way you could do that is just if you just straight up just stop producing oil or producing energy. Yeah, you can get to zero emissions that way, but you'll probably facilitate a number of riots and
certain to some extent societal collapse. So it's probably not what you want.
Yeah, no, it's like
so rather carbon neutrality would allow people to, you know, for to slowly phase out fossil fuels as you slowly start finding new ways of producing new energy. You start offsetting, you know, produce less and less carbon, and you start producing more and more renewables.
Yeah.
Until eventually the amount of carbon you're producing is negligible compared to the amount of carbon you're taking out.
Mm, absolutely. And
so the future might not necessarily be one without any carbon at all, but rather one, like, I don't think we're going to get to the point quite yet where we can totally have no carbon at all, but it will be carbon that's offset by so many other factors. It's not going to be the majority means of our energy, but probably be a older scale method of producing energy.
Yeah. And speaking about other ways of producing energy, nuclear is often, in my eyes, you don't have to agree with this, but often is excluded a lot in this energy conversation as well. And sometimes it doesn't really get its high, you know, its plaudits, let's say, and it gets a lot of critics. Yeah, I don't understand. For me, I don't really understand why it's not in the same. It's not valued the same in this conversation of energy. So I just want to ask, like, what? Why does it? Does nuclear energy deserve its bad reputation?
I don't think it does. I think it's something that you have a couple. Like, it's a bit different in that there are ways in which you can do nuclear energy poorly. And there are, you know, issues where if you do it poorly, it can have bad effects. And where you have the large publicized, well-known and well-documented cases like Fukushima and Chernobyl. And those are the kinds of issues that people think of when they think of it. But, you know, France has 60 nuclear reactors across their country. How many meltdowns have they had?
Yeah, no, that's true, actually.
Problems have they had? You know, people can think of two off the top of their head, but how many nuclear reactors are there in total? And it does seem more dangerous in comparison to something like, you know, wind turbines. You're not going to expecting a wind turbine to, you know, have a meltdown and start giving, you know, just giving radiation to birds. That's not, you know, it's more likely just to hit birds instead.
Yeah, no, exactly. No, that's true.
So it's something that can have a more dangerous and tangible effect. But at the same time, we have produced so many new, there are new designs for reactors that can, when they fail, they fail into inertia. So they can't be capable of really breaking down. It's built by design. So, and if you watch the series Chernobyl, I haven't actually watched it myself. I'm largely going off what I've read about it, is that it's largely about showing that the issues itself aren't necessarily with nuclear energy itself, but also just kind of the workplace and the workplace culture and the government style of the Soviet Union. You had drunken scientists, you have a government that really wants to cover things up, represent, have a show a good face, not communicate transparently with the public. Those are all factors that exacerbated the issue, that made it worse than it should have been.
Mm.
Rather than it being an inherent fault of nuclear energy all in total. So I think a lot of people are just kind of scared of nuclear energy and what its potential harms are. But at the same time, the amount of waste, like I said earlier, is the amount of waste it creates is very small and very manageable. All the nuclear reactors waste in the United States can all fit in one football field. Then you can imagine, you know, that's, we reuse so much more space just for landfills. Like, that's not even like one landfill. Like, imagine if we could have power our entire country and not all the waste it creates is one landfill's worth. That's nothing.
Yeah.
Like, and so in terms of if we need to get off carbon, you know, I think in the long run, yeah, maybe you don't want nuclear because it does have that waste will accumulate over time, and depending on how much, and while it is a manageable amount, it's, if we're going to ramp it up, it's going to create more.
But
this other, at the other hand, it's, you know, we can't get all the energy we need from solar and wind, from wind turbines and solar panels. We need to do more. And so that seems like a pretty good trade-off, in my opinion. You're essentially swapping highly polluting forms of energy production for a slightly less producing, that produces highly toxic materials in very small quantities that can be much more easily managed and controlled. You know, it'd be a lot worse if all the radiation just, you know, went into the air. We can't really take it out, but rather we have physical rods that we can actually physically handle and sequester ourselves on our own. It's much easier to do than trying to take, you know, hundreds of millions and billions of tiny little carbon dioxide molecules out of the air.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's the fact that, I kind of feel like nuclear energy is, I think it should be part of the conversation. I just don't really understand why. I agree. It's the fact that a lot of people have these reservations because of these nuclear mistakes like Chernobyl. I watched the TV series. It was a really good drama series. It definitely showed what you were saying about, it was the fact it was the workplace culture. It was trying to hide a lot of the mistakes. It was just workforce error. It wasn't, and it was the fact like, no, the fact is, right, that Chernobyl event happened in the 1980s. I can't remember the exact date it happened, but it happened in the 1980s. Mm-hmm. We've changed a lot. Nuclear energy has changed a lot. The fact that I think I'm hearing there's lots of developments in nuclear energy where it's becoming, I'm not saying it's safer, but let's say there's a lot of, you know, technology has changed, right? Mm-hmm. Worker rights has changed. So there's a lot, because when Chernobyl happened, it was a very different time to now where we are now, where you mentioned in France, there's lots of nuclear reactors which probably go through these certain procedures, which is great. Mm-hmm. In terms of protection. So, and the fact is, yeah, like if countries like the UK, like Canada, like United States rely so much on these traditional, have like the biggest economies in the world, right? Well, not the biggest economies in the world, but like, you know what I mean? Like they have a lot of money. Let's just say that. Why, like, I think investing in nuclear energy would be, I would say in the short term, pretty reasonable. Of course, when you're using nuclear energy too much, you then mentioned, yeah, that will create a lot of waste, more than these, you know, American football fields. Yeah, true. But the fact is, would you rather have a nuclear energy station than, let's say, a coal power station? I would rather have a nuclear power station, especially when, then you then need these regulations involved, where you have the right sort of, you know, protections in place. Definitely. I think that's when we have to do that, in that sense.
Well, absolutely. I mean, nuclear was the energy of the future in the 50s and 60s. You know, that's when a lot of these countries built their reactors we're in the atomic era and we've harnessed the power of the atom and we can use it for our own purposes. But I think there was, some of the anti-nuclear movement in terms of weapons kind of overlapped with in terms of anti-nuclear energy, and then you had Chernobyl that really kind of, you know, that was the big one that really, I think, there was the first big incident that really showed the world that, hey, nuclear might not be potentially as safe as we thought it was. Mm. And I think that might have been useful in certain, I think it was quite easy for people to kind of draw that line, like, hey, yeah, like nuclear energy is just bad and period. Nuclear is bad. You have nuclear bombs and you have Chernobyl. You know, we don't want that. That's not good. That's not good for the environment. But like I said, I don't think there's going to be a way in which we can produce energy that's going to be totally, totally clean without any kind of impacts. But what we need is find new forms of energy that are going to minimize those impacts, to get those to a minimum, so we can produce energy with, you know, with keeping the destruction of the planet down to a minimum, and hopefully to an amount that can be managed and reversed.
Definitely. And yeah, you're just on top of your point about talking about Chernobyl and all these nuclear disasters. It's actually quite interesting. So I found this, I found these statistics where, well, not statistic, but to move some countries. So after the 2011 Fukushima disaster in Japan, Japan decides to close its nuclear industry altogether. Then countries like Belgium, Switzerland, and Italy then decided to decline to replace existing reactors or even move forward with plans for new nuclear plants. And this was reported by the BBC, the countries building miniature nuclear reactors. So yeah, it shows that nuclear disasters sometimes try and like push off a lot of these politicians by like not wanting to create these reactors because they're scared like that's going to happen again. But at the same time, ahead.
Oh, just to say, yeah, I think I agree. It's a matter of public opinion. The public sees these highly publicized and meltdown, and the public sees, the amount of impact it's having on people and the environment, and they see, I don't want that. Of course, we're not going to have it. But, you know, Fukushima wasn't the result of the failure of the power plant itself. It was the result of an earthquake. That's the thing, is some of these issues aren't necessarily a result of... aren't the fault of nuclear energy on its own. It's, you know, Chernobyl was poor management and poor design. Quakes all the time.
Yeah, of course. I didn't actually know it was Fukushima was on an earthquake. I forgot about that. Didn't even know that. That's really, that is interesting. So yeah, that kind of just defeats the argument as well. That definitely defeats it. It's, okay, let's try and like maybe move away from nuclear energy. Mm-hmm. But what would you say, like, how has the energy sector changed? How is it changing like right now, would you say?
Well, I think there's all sorts of new different ways that people are creating to try and create energy or try to harness different kinds of energy that are being taken. So for example, there's I saw one thing about these essentially panels that take kinetic energy from rain and then channel that into power. Mm. So yeah, London might not be able to get solar panels, but I think they do quite well with rain panels.
Yeah.
Can we take this and put it in something like, put them on things like waterfalls or even just they're talking about that you can put these in your, that this technology could even be put in like rain jackets or umbrellas and power, you know, small little things.
Oh, interesting.
There's also there's also that future of, you know, micro generation, you know, having people produce power on their own, at their own house, at their own scale, or even capture different kinds of kinetic energy. You know, imagine if your shoes could capture the kinetic energy of you walking and then could store that for a little bit.
Yeah. I was actually, I read somewhere as well. So this was, this was a article done by Sam Meyer on Disruptor Daily, and he was speaking to 16 experts on the energy sector. And he was speaking to, I think this was a quote from Steve Hoy, who is a CEO of Enosi Australia. And he kind of suggested there'll be like greater decentralization in the use of things like power grids. So the fact that I think we use power a lot from nationally, whereas I think we might have to go towards a bit more decentralization and use more local power stations, which is interesting. So that kind of goes off your point, the fact that, yeah, we might have to go towards a little bit more of a localized use of energy in that sense.
I mean, the UK is already starting off with those kinds of initiatives with their incentives to purchase energy from, you know, producers to add it to the national grid.
Mm.
So, yeah. You know, there's that incentive where if you put in your own solar panels and you produce your own energy, any excess the national grid will purchase from you.
Oh, yeah, that is true, actually. I saw that. Yeah. No, that's interesting. Does Canada have the same sort of idea or not really?
I think it depends on the province. I don't think there's quite anything there. Or if there are, they're like not great tax credits or something. I remember when I went to the UK, I was impressed with that, with that little model. We don't have much like that. But those kinds of things, it could definitely help facilitate it. Creating an incentive for people to invest in their own, because that's the other thing, you don't have to necessarily do it. You don't have to have governments to create all these new things, but if we can make consumer goods that are affordable for people, you know, everyone's has an interest in reducing their power bill. And I'm sure people also have, you know, want to have a clearer conscience about their energy impact. Mm-hmm. So well, there's all sorts of incentives. So there's all sorts of different ways that we can incentivize people to reduce their own electrical and energy footprints.
Mm, yeah.
Either by creating their own energy or by reducing the amount of energy they consume.
Yeah, consumers definitely play a huge role, actually, in the energy sector. It's the fact that how much we use energy. And the fact there's, well, there's, you know, there's technologies being developed where we can just control how much we use energy, not just, you know, through a little, what's that word? Like a little heating control, but you can actually get like a tablet and then control it that way, you know? So it's like, yeah. Even technology can play a huge role in this as well.
Oh, absolutely. There's all the other... This thing isn't just necessarily producing more energy, but also using our energy more efficiently. So there's all sorts of different, because for take one example for the UK is there's all sorts of different algorithms for energy production to ramp up. I believe during Premier League games, during the halftime, they have to basically rank up electrical production because everyone puts on their kettles at the same time.
Yes, that is true. Yeah, I've read somewhere. Yes,
and
yes.
So the UK has to, you can have algorithms that can determine, you know, figure out when energy usage is going to spike and then move and increase production accordingly and then decrease production when during downtimes.
Mm. Yeah.
Also different ways of doing that or even just different ways of capturing energy that gets lost. Like one example is, you know, remember incandescent light bulbs that used to be really hot, those are wasteful because they were most of the energy is created as heat. It basically just heats up a filament so much that it starts producing light. But the majority of the energy produced is released as heat, not as light, which is why they're so much more inefficient compared to fluorescent bulbs. So anything that, so lots of our different processes that create heat, you know, that heat could be recaptured. Imagine car engines. You know, what if we had different ways to capture the heat that's released in a car engine and recapture that?
Mm. Yeah, definitely. It's definitely, it seems how the reason, yeah, why energy is changing is, yeah, it definitely seems it's a way to save energy because it helps for the environment. And yeah, it's also the fact it's because of technological innovation as well. It's huge. I think it seems that technological innovation and that environment is going hand in hand with a lot of these things, like energy, like we're discussing today, and like other things as well, like construction as well, like all various different industries. 100%. Yeah, no, it's interesting. And I just thought we don't want to like run out of too much time, but like, how might we get our energy in the future, would you say?
I think we'll see a lot more microgeneration, and I think we'll find all sorts of new and novel ways. I'm sure there's, I think I read an article about some bacteria that could take, you know, that could create hydrogen that could be used for, you know, hydrogen fuel cells.
Ooh.
That's the other thing is we haven't even gotten into the different potential sources of bioenergy using different organisms and to produce energy for us or to produce chemicals that can be used for energy. You know, if biological sources of energy could really change the game and can help, could especially help different countries and places that don't have the geography favorable for exploiting different kinds of natural energy sources.
Mm. So the fact that we use the fact there's a growth of biomaterials, yeah, it definitely is a possibility for bioenergy, 100%. Mm. You know, so it's, yeah, it will definitely be interesting. And then on top of those, you know, that we've mentioned like bioenergy, is there any other like big technologies that might be more prevalent in the future that helps with energy?
I can't really name anything in particular, but I think it's just those small little things of new different way, you know, how do we capture energy from rain? How do we capture energy from all these different little
different little pieces of energy, or different, all the different little things in our lives and all the different little ways that we do. I mean, humans produce energy on a huge scale. I mean, that's kind of the plot point of the Matrix, is the robots use human beings as batteries.
Yeah.
So there's like, we, you know, even just moving creates a lot of kinetic energy. There's energy all around. There's just, it's all a matter of how do we capture and control it.
Definitely. Yeah. And the fact is, yeah, I think it is a way of trying to find a way to, yeah, what you said, like use the energy in for like efficient means and means that we kind of want it for. Mm-hmm. And also for a way to try and, it's best not to waste it as well, and to like find energy sources that don't also contribute to the environment. Also, and then also to try and go in hand with our technological advancements, which is very clear to see. But yeah, and also the fact that like, consumers do play a huge role as well in our usage of energy. Because this is what I saw in Gov UK, the fact that, yeah, they were going on about, you know, consumers being quite a big, huge in it, and like in ways of, you know, reducing that energy usage and also trying to find ways of doing that, 100%. Yeah. Definitely. Yeah, this has been a really good conversation, actually, about energy. Super interesting. We went, even though we didn't go too much in depth about like the future of energy, I think we also talked a lot about what's going on right now, where the uses of renewables and things like nuclear as well. So yeah, we'll definitely go into our weak signals then. I kind of found a really good weak signal, which was about blood test accurately detecting Alzheimer's disease. I think that's how, Alzheimer's disease. Well, I've completely butchered that. Alzheimer's disease. Right. So it's McGill. McGill University found a blood test that was able to measure one of the proteins that is implicated in in this disease, according to a new study. I'm not even going to pronounce this. I can't. I just can't. It's fine. All right. So yeah, originally you were able to detect this disease through an expensive PET scan or a invasive lumbar or like punches or autopsy. I'm really bad with my words today. So bad. But anyway, this blood test is able to detect this disease much more efficiently, and also like a lot less cost as well. So that's really great. And so yeah, this kind of weak signal is definitely changing the way we kind of can identify diseases, and the fact we can do it way more efficiently and not having to use such expensive equipment. And also this test can also be used not just in older people, but also younger patients as well. So really interesting weak signal. This was on a website called Futurity. So yeah, really cool story, and something very interesting to look into. So yeah, John, what do you think about this weak signal?
Yeah, no, I like it. It's I think what impressed me about it was that it can be found, that the protein can be found in such small amounts that it can be detected before a person shows any symptoms. So hopefully,
yeah, that is true.
You go in for a routine blood test and like, oh, you know, you think you might be developing Alzheimer's, here, we'll put you on this thing so you don't even end up developing it at all.
That was true, actually.
Preventative, yeah. Measure, Alzheimer's might, you know, it could really help make Alzheimer's much more preventable and much more manageable in the future. If people can start getting, you know, nipping it right before it even has a chance to really manifest. And then also the fact that it's a simple blood test means that these expensive PET scanners aren't really available in a lot of parts of the world. They're expensive, and some countries might only have one for their populations of millions. So
yeah,
exactly. These blood tests could really help make it more accessible and just help improve the health of everyone.
It also kind of changes the way, not just for this disease, but it could also help identify other diseases as well, like hugely. If we're able to develop this sort of biomarker, let's say, I think this is what they call it, to meet other diseases, I think this will be very, very big in terms of identifying other diseases, which might be very, very common within, you know, wild populations. So yeah, very, very interesting. Very, very interesting. So what is your weak signal as well?
Yeah. So I got one about a career assignment AI. So in December 2019, scientists at the University of New South Wales found a quantitative correlation between job title and personality type. So they created a vocational compass by running 100,000 Twitter profiles with listed job titles through personality analysis AI based on language usage and online interactions. And then this compass powers another AI that can be given that can predict a given job title based on their Twitter personality. And it can predict a person's job with 70% accuracy. And errors are minor, usually often confusions between jobs with similar titles or similar job skill sets, like a school principal or a superintendent or a poet and a fictional writer.
Mm.
So this could be quite interesting because global job satisfaction isn't very high. It's estimated that only about 13% of the global workforce feels engaged at work. And
wait,
numerous
what?
Studies.
Yeah, 13%.
Yeah. No.
Oh my god, that's really bad. Jeez. That's pretty bad. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Have you ever worked service before?
Oh yeah, true.
Yeah, no, it's not engaging.
Not engaging.
But numerous studies show a strong correlation between job satisfaction and mental health. So an AI that could help people find a more satisfying career path, especially as, you know, job focuses, especially as automation forces many into retraining. This could lead to a more productive workforce that where people find work less dreadful.
Yeah.
Employers could also use it to inform and expedite the hiring process. But this could also be a problem because AI systems reflect their input data. And so if most people are presently in jobs they don't like and aren't engaged in, then why are we feeding it data about people who don't like their jobs? Because if job performance is... Because job performance is a related but ultimately separate metric than job satisfaction.
Mm.
So, you know, if it could really just exacerbate all the unsatisfaction we see today. So we can't just be a means of, you know, we don't necessarily want a world where, yeah, it determines what our job is, but maybe it helps guide us.
Yeah, that is true, actually. Yeah, that's interesting. I think it's a really, that's really cool that kind of, well, the fact that it's AI. Is it AI? Yeah, this AI could just do this. It's very interesting. But yeah, I agree with that last part. It's the fact you don't want this AI to just tell you, oh, this job is perfect for you. You know, I think it's great that we have all these technologies, but we cannot have technology dictating us. We got to try and dictate the technology, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. Well, on the other hand, it could be, any bad job, you know, a potential employer will run you through their profile. Like, oh, I don't think you'll be a good fit because you don't seem to have the same kind of, this AI doesn't think you'd be a good fit. But in reality, maybe you do have a good fit.
Yeah, that's true.
You're just not the same kind of, you don't have the same kind of personality on the jobs. Depending on how it could be used, imagine where people get segmented based on, you know, you can always kind of say that certain people in certain jobs have different kind of personalities, but, you know, that could really exacerbate it.
And also, I feel like, because you've said this technology uses Twitter bios, right?
Well, that's what they did the test with Twitter bios, yeah.
Yeah. So, and the question is, right, usually we keep our, sometimes, it depends on the person, right? But sometimes you have social media, we keep our social media quite away from our work. Sometimes, I don't think this is completely true, but mm-hmm. some people might want to keep our social media, like keep our Twitter away from work. So our work is very separate from Twitter. So we might tweet about, I don't know, politics, but you're working as, I don't know, in a boutique, right? Could this AI then mistaken this person based on You know what I mean? Like, it could be very mistaken. Well,
because that's the thing, is these aren't people tweeting about work. This is, it takes the language and how, what they use and how they interact with other people. Because it's, so there's other, so this AI is built on a separate AI that analyzes people's personalities based on the language they use in different social media contexts. So you can be taking their email, their Facebook, Twitter, you know, whatever, any kinds of writing samples of that person and showing examples of how they interact with other people. So,
okay.
So pretty much the only way they did it is like they looked at person, you know, does this Twitter account, do they say what their job title is on their profile? Okay, that's all we really need to do. And then the rest of it is just looking at what the personality is like. It doesn't really matter whether they're talking about their job or not.
Okay.
So it's not what they talk about, it's how they talk about it.
Ah, gotcha. Gotcha. So it's more the tone. Okay. It's more the tone
vocabulary, what they say, what they don't say.
Gotcha. Okay. Fair enough. Cause that was the thing. Cause I wasn't sure, like, because the fact social media is our own social media might be so different from our own work, might create a bit of an imbalance, but the fact it's not just looking at your social media as a face value is actually going more in depth about the tone and, that's actually really cool then. Okay, that is cool. But again, yeah, we have to still be a bit wary about this. It's interesting though.
Interesting. Well, it's like that one Black Mirror episode where this girl's boyfriend dies, and so she ends up basically essentially buying an android that looks like him and has been fed all his social media and emails and all that to create a model of his personality, but it's not a complete it's very similar, but it's not a complete version of him, because you don't put everything on social media.
Yeah.
What you present is a very curated and performed version of yourself.
Of course.
It's you, but it's not quite you.
Yeah, I know what you mean. It's not feeling the same sort of I know what you mean. It doesn't cover like everything. Yeah, completely. It's no, that's a really interesting weak signal, John. Thank you. And yeah, that was John's weak signal, and then of course my weak signal. And then yeah, I think we've had a really great conversation about energy, especially looking into, you know, renewables, conversation about nuclear, and also what the future may hold for this particular industry. So yeah, thank you, John, for coming into this call. And yeah, you can tune in to next week for another episode. You can find the rest of our episodes on Spotify and on Apple Podcasts. Until next week, stay tuned. Thank you. Bye.